session number 25699, Reel 2.
Reel 2. You were describing how you received orders in the shell room when you were at action stations.
Via a voice pipe. That's all. No telephones. There were telephones in the ship on the bridge and to other parts of the ship, but not to the placeless like the shell room. So it was somebody shouting down a voice pipe.
Can you describe the hierarchy of the seaman branch that you were in? The chain of command, as it were?
Well, if I go back to the mess, there was always a leading seaman in charge of the mess, and then a number of able seamen, ordinary seamen. But when I was in as a boy seaman, I was in a separate mess deck, in the boy seaman's mess deck.
Well, I mean, when you were working, how did that...
Well, you took orders mainly from petty officers or leading seamen, and to do mundane jobs in the ship, like keeping it clean and moving stores, etc. It wasn't long before I was an ordinary seaman because of my age. Once I became 17, later in February, I was promoted, if that's the right word, to ordinary seaman. So then I went to one of the other messes where other seamen and ABs, etc. were.
Before we move on to living accommodation, can I just ask you a bit more about your jobs? Once you became an ordinary seaman, did you keep those jobs as a lookout?
No. I didn't keep the commander's messenger job, no. So then I had to do the mundane jobs with the rest of the division. I was in the focus division, and we had to do things like keep the deck scrubbed, move stores, anything mundane, yes. But I wasn't the commander's messenger anymore because I come out from being a boy seaman. But I still stayed as a lookout in my watchkeeping in the Red Watch.
I should have asked this before, but when you were a lookout, you said there were 12 of you, six on, six off.
That's right.
Who was in charge of the lookouts?
Well, we had an officer in charge on the ADP. In my watch, it was the captain of the Marines. He was in charge. And he used to keep us on our toes and report anything to the bridge that we'd seen. There were also two midshipmen. I felt very sorry for two of them because they were from India and they were doing training in this country for the Indian Navy, and here they were up in the Arctic, quite foreign to this sort of climate. But yes, two midshipmen and a captain of Marines. Other watches had probably either a sub-lieutenant or a lieutenant on duty. So there was an officer on the watch on the ADP as well.
You started to talk about your mess.
Yes.
Can you describe the living arrangements, the messing arrangements?
A scrubbed table to seat about 20 people, 10 either side, on stools. No chairs. Most of the crockery was kept in a sort of a... How can I describe it? Not a dresser. It was a metal dresser where everything had to be hung up and closed down because of the ship rolling. Two at the time from the mess took turns of being cooks. We're called cooks of the mess. It really meant we had to go and get the meals and bring them down and serve the meals out on the plates to the people in the mess and then do the washing up afterwards. So we had perhaps 2 days doing that duty, sorry. And then somebody else took over.
Would that be in addition to all your other duties?
Oh, yes, that's in addition to all the other duties, of course, yes. Yes. Had leisure time during the evening if he was off watch. We could write letters, perhaps, yes. And play Ludo, draughts, get your hair cut. Probably had to turn it, well, pipe down was always at 10 o'clock, so you had to be in your hammock by 10 o'clock. And of course, if you've got the middle watch, you wanted to be in a bit earlier than that because you was called at about 11:45 to go on watch for the 4 hours from midnight onwards.
Did everyone have their own special place for their hammock in the mess, or didn't it matter?
It really didn't matter, but we all liked to think we had, and we usually slung our hammocks, as that's the word for it, in about the same place every time, and that was always above the mess table. So you were actually eating and living on the mess deck, on the table, and sleeping in a hammock above it.
You talked about leisure time mm-hmm. in the evenings. Did you always spend it in your mess, or were there any other facilities available?
There was a little, what they called a little drinks bar, not alcohol, like lemonade and stuff like that, on the next deck up. But it was so small and got so crowded, it was very difficult ever to get in there. So most of us made our own leisure by things I've described, like playing draft, Ludo, chatting, writing letters. Not necessarily staying in the same mess, but communicating with, going into other messes and talking to some of your mates that you've made friends with. Probably from the same watch as you. So we weren't all in the same mess at that stage.
Any sports organised?
Not very much, because our main base was Scupper Flow, but we were often at Reykjavik, or near Reykjavik. There was football ashore, but mostly the weather prohibited most of the play. So very little sports, indeed. It was only allowed ashore once, if we were in harbour, one evening, or from about 4 o'clock till about 8 o'clock, something like that, every fourth day. So 3 days on duty and some shore leave, so-called, where there was a canteen, where you were able to drink, get beer, but you was rationed to one bottle per person per night. Wasn't very good beer anyway. We did have some ENSA programs up there, and I do remember, although I didn't see her, Gracie Fields came up there one particular time into Scapa Flow, but I didn't actually see her.
Can you remember the names of any of the other entertainers who came up to do the ENSA show?
I don't know. I don't think I can. Gracie Fields sticks out in my mind because he was quite a personality in her time.
What about cinema? Were there any films put on, either on board or ashore?
There was a cinema on board, but really this was later on in my career in the Suffolk, not so much in the Northern Waters. I don't remember any cinemas in the Arctic. We couldn't have been on the upper deck for it anyway, because it was so, the weather was so bad. And we couldn't use the hangar, which was later used in the Suffolk's career, as a cinema, because we had seaplanes, we had Walruses, three at one time, and they were on the house and the hangar on the catapult that they were shot off by.
What about religious observance? Were there religious ceremonies or religious...
Religious services were compulsory. Every Sunday morning, if we were in harbour, we went to what we called divisions. We had to put our best suits on. We were inspected by the captain. Following that, there was a religious service, which was compulsory, yes. At sea, sometimes the padre gave us an address over the loudspeakers on Sunday mornings. Or sometimes other times. If we were going into action, he would come on and pray for everybody. Which was a little daunting. I think Roman Catholics, and I wasn't one, were allowed ashore if we were in harbour to go to a Roman Catholic church on Sunday morning for an hour or something like that. But we were having our religious service aboard anyway.
How did you keep in contact with people at home?
Again, by letter, either airmail or the photograph letter I described just now. There was no other way. And so mail post was something to look forward to. When we came in from our patrols at Reykjavik, in the Denmark Strait, back towards Reykjavik, one big thing was the mail. If it had arrived, we were all hoping to get some letters from home. But that was a little bit few and far between at times. Our patrols on that particular duty were 10 days out on patrol and 3 days in harbour. That was the routine. And so sometimes both Suffolk and Norfolk were on patrol at the same time.
Did you ever fall foul of the censor? Did you have any problems?
I think sometimes that they put the blue pencil through, as they used to. Well, I'd said something that perhaps I shouldn't have done, and so when my parents got it, there was a bit scored out. But I never got into any trouble over it. It was, in fact, the padre and his team were the chief censors of the ship, and all your letters went through them.
Were there any occasions when non-censored letters were allowed through?
Not that I can remember. Not through the whole war.
And where would you get the letters from? How would you receive them?
If we were in Helpfield near Reykjavik, they'd obviously come up from Scapa Flow by sea, and we would get them, and they were sometimes maybe as much as 2 months old, but all longer than that.
Was there a special post for them or anything?
We had a rate in a leading seaman on board who did the postal duties, and he used to go ashore and collect the mail from, I think it was an Isen hut in this place, where it had been assembled, and come back aboard and then bring it round to the different messes. We weren't just given the mail as a whole, we were able to call out as he distributed the mail, the letters. And sometimes it was disappointing if you didn't get one. But always something to look forward to.
What happened if somebody got a Dear John letter?
Well, I wasn't really old enough to be in that sort of life, so I suppose this did happen. But at 17 and coming 18 years old, it wasn't part of my life, and I don't know of anybody that got one, but obviously it must have happened.
Do you want to break?
No, I just wondered if I should put the heating on again. I think the heating's gone off.
I'm fine, actually.
You're okay? Yeah.
What was the discipline like on board?
Well, very military. I mean, we were organised into ships, parts of ship. I was in what they called the focus division, and there would be a petty officer of the focus division who could be at times quite harsh, but if I keep going back to my background from the Mercury onwards, I never found any of it as harsh as it was then. And so I'm not saying it was an easy life. It wasn't. But not that harsh, not in my opinion.
Did anyone, or did you, fall foul of any rules and regulations?
I didn't fall foul myself. I might have had one or two hiccups where I might have not got up early enough and was got stoppage of leave or something like that for that, but not that it mattered too much because there wasn't much leave. But yes, there were one or two who stepped out of line, and there was, unfortunately, a cell block in the ship, two cells, and if somebody committed a serious offence, they were put in the cells.
Did you ever appear before the captain as a defaulter?
No, only as a request man.
Who did you go to if you had any welfare problems or any?
We had a divisional officer, and the divisional officer of the focus division was a Lieutenant Taylor. He was RNVR, so he wasn't a regular naval person. He was quite a nice fella, and you could go to them. Not at any time, through the either your petty officer or somebody like that, or go to the padre. But I can't remember ever doing that.
Do you have any particular memories of the ship's company? Or indeed anybody on board HMS Suffolk?
Well, yes, I was on board Suffolk for 4.5 years. So although there was a change in crew, except for a nucleus officer who stayed all the time, yes, I knew many people. I knew Alf Newell quite well. He was in the next mess to me. He was the man at first sight of the Bismarck. And I can't remember all names now. I mean, it's a long time ago. But I could see faces. And yes, when we played football, I remember Alf used to keep goal, and I used to play in the team. most of the ship's company were hostilities only. So they were only in for the duration of the war, whereas I was a regular, and all the boys seamen obviously were regulars, and only a small nucleus of the ship's company really were regular serving people.
Any particular stories about anyone?
That's difficult. I suppose I ought to have, but just at the moment I don't recall anything salient.
What about naval traditions on board? I know you were too young to receive your rum ration to start off with.
Yeah.
But did you take it later on when you were old enough?
Did I take what?
The rum ration.
I did when I was eligible, yes. Or you had the alternative of becoming temp and get paid three old pennies a day for it. So perhaps it's where I started going wrong, I don't know. Because I believe I mentioned when I left the HMS St George, I was recommended for a candidate for sub-lieutenant. Well, soon after I joined the Suffolk, things started. I became despondent, as I've explained, about the weather, the conditions, which were miserable, and it wasn't the Navy I thought I joined, and eventually I didn't make that grade.
Were you put forward as a potential officer?
Yeah, I was, and I took examinations. I passed the education examinations for them, but possibly because I used to go ashore and have a drink with the boys, things like that, I don't know. Nobody ever tells you why, but it just started natural.
You started talking about being ashore. What did you do ashore when you had the opportunity?
Well, in those places, there was nowhere else to go but the canteen. I mean, it was a very desolate place on the side of a mountain. There was an old coal burner in the middle of the Nissen hut. And your one bottle per person per night per day ration. And just sit around and chat. I think there were darts and things like that, playing darts and that sort of thing. But
any interaction with any other ships?
I think the first football team, the people who made the grades, to be because it was good footballers, played other ships, but I didn't do that. No. We met other ships' companies ashore, and had general discussions on our experiences and what had and what hadn't happened. But mainly with Norfolk, Suffolk and Norfolk were always seemed to be together.
Any other naval traditions that you remember?
Such as?
Make and mend. Any special language?
Yeah, make and mend. Yes, you mentioned that. Now, make and mend was the afternoon off, wasn't it? And if the commander so desired and thought enough work had been done in the mornings, he would declare make and mend in the afternoon, when other people would get their heads down to sleep, write letters, play Ludo, try to do things to keep you from being bored. But there was a radio, a ship's radio going, where you could ask for request tunes. Am I going back far enough? Frank Sinatra and people like that. Perhaps it was before his day, I don't know.
What about, did you organise any entertainments? Were you involved in the entertainments? Amateur dramatics?
No, I didn't do that, no.
Any language or phrases that you can remember being used?
Well, language I couldn't mention, obviously, because there was quite a lot of industrial language used. Unfortunately, you look back and you're not proud of it, but that was the way of the thing, the services in those days. It was almost commonplace expression of your language or your personality. It came out, a lot of it came out in foul language.
Do you have any particular slang or language that's peculiar to the Navy?
Well, certain ditties about other ships, which I wouldn't like to repeat.
Well, you can if you like.
the Satsangas roll on the Nelson, the Rodney, the Hood, this three-funneled so-and-so is no so-and-so good. That's a ditty I can remember. And I don't know where it stemmed from. It had been in naval traditions long before my time. Looking back, I'm very proud of it, because you get caught up in these things from some of the more hardliners, if you like.
You say you were, when you joined in Suffolk, after she'd worked up, that you were on patrol in the Denmark Strait.
Yes.
10 days on...
3 days in, that was about,
You described a little bit about that. Can you remember any particular incidents that occurred during that time on patrol?
Well, the big one, of course, was the sighting of the Bismarck.
Can you start from the beginning and explain what was the first that you knew, first thing you knew about the Bismarck?
Yes. We'd come in off patrol from our 10-day patrol, and then there was a big flap. We suddenly had to get more ammunition on stores. We worked through the night. We all knew there was something going on, but nobody had said, I think. First thing the next morning, about 5:30, we were back out to sea again, and we were steaming north up the Denmark Strait at high speed. And nothing was said until about 6 o'clock that evening, which I think I'm right in saying is the 23rd of May. Was it the 22nd? Anyway, the commander came on to the give a broadcast to say that we were steaming north to join with Norfolk, because two heavy units, German heavy units, had left their anchorage in Bergen, Norway. If they came our way, we were likely to see them perhaps in the next 24 hours. That was at 6 o'clock, and I was just going on watch on the second dog. So I heard his broadcast. And we got on watch. Did our usual to and from, and nothing happening. Suddenly at 7:20, Alf Neil to my right shouted ship, and then two ships. And I swung my binoculars round, and steaming up fast from behind us, coming up from behind us on our starboard quarter, Bismarck leading with the Prince Eugen.
Can you remember, can you describe the scene in a bit more detail? How far were they away from you?
What had actually happened is that the weather, which was closed right down, had suddenly lifted, and they were there on our starboard quarter. And I know the distance, because right behind me in the forward control, there was a communication person who was repeating messages from the radar office. And although we'd seen them first visually, I heard him say, "Echo bearing green 140." 12,000, and that was 12,000 yards. 12,000 yards is 6 nautical miles. 6 nautical miles for a ship like the Bismarck to us was point blank.
Did you know it was the Bismarck at that stage?
Not at that particular stage. We knew it was one of the heavy units they described. But later the captain, who was sending his messages to the Admiralty, mentioned Bismarck. Well, first of all, he said one battleship, one cruiser. And then I think he corrected it to Bismarck, because it obviously was the Bismarck.
So your friend Alf Newell was the first person to see those ships?
Yes.
Followed by you?
I saw it within seconds of him seeing it, yeah.
What happened once those ships had been sighted?
The captain came up onto the ADP from the bridge in about two strides. He stood right next to me, and he was issuing his orders in the voice pipe, which was close to me. He said something, I can't remember word for word, but something like, "Make to Admiralty." This was, he was talking to his officer of the watch, just to get the message sent out. "Make to Admiralty, one battleship, one cruiser, give bearing, position, course, and speed. Hands to General Quarters." He used the word General Quarters. The Marine Bugler then sounded off action stations. The alarm rattlers were going, making the Morse code word S for surface, and everybody in the ship was rushing backwards and forwards, and it was complete. It seemed to be complete chaos, organised chaos, I think they used to call it.
Did you go to action station at that point?
I had to wait till I was relieved. I must And by then, what had happened, the captain had altered course to port, and we were doing a big sweep round away from the Bismarck to come up, in fact, behind them. We were in front of them at the time we sighted them. They were on our starboard quarter. Why they didn't fire on us, I'll never know, because we must have been point blank for them. Whether they hoped we hadn't seen them or didn't want any disturbance, because they was intent on getting into the Atlantic, I don't know. But once I was relieved, I had to make my way down into the shell room. And I remember that hatch being clamped down, and then I was a little bit scared.
What happened when you were at your action station?
Well, we followed the Bismarck through the night, and we were getting reports by the captain or the commander on what was going on. I think we lost them at one time in a snowstorm, and then picked them up again, and then we were told that the Hood and Prince of Wales were on course, ready to intercept the first thing in the morning.
So you were at your action station all night?
I was there all the time from then on, yes. Kept in touch, though, by broadcast on what was going on. We were told that the engagement had started between the heavy ships, Hood, Prince of Wales, Bismarck. That was just before 6 o'clock. And then to our dismay, at about 6:10, the captain came on and said, and I remember his words, "Hood's blown up, broken into and sunk." Now, the Hood was a legend in the Navy, as most people would know. It was, we thought, the most powerful battle cruiser in the world. But of course, it was 20 years old. The Bismarck was brand new. And she was hitting one of her ammunition. And she just blew up. Now,
I was still
in the shower room.
What was your reaction to that news, and what was the reaction of those around you?
A stunned disbelief. We could not believe that Hood had been sunk. We thought somebody made a mistake. In fact, the people on watch, who were quoting afterwards, who actually saw what happened, cheered when they saw it, because they thought it was the Bismarck that was, because they were a little bit far off than us, about 12 miles away then. They thought it was the Bismarck that was going up, but no, it wasn't, it was the Hood. And then it became a point where we opened fire. We fired, in all, throughout the actions, we fired 96 rounds.
You fired at that point?
Just after the Bismarck, we got the message that the Hood had been sunk, we opened fire, yes.
Can you describe what that was like, being down the shore, and what you heard and the smells?
Well, the guns, the ATAR above us, went off with a terrific roar, and everything shakes. And then we were getting the shells off the boxes and passed them round the rails and pushed them up the chute to keep the guns fed. So it was all action then. Didn't have much time to think about what might happen. It was, you know, we were so busy.
Was it noisy in the shell?
Very noisy, yes. I mean, the turret was only just not very far above us, so when the guns opened the fire, it was tremendous. I don't remember being frightened. In fact, because I was only 18 years old then, I think, once again, you don't see the dangers of that when you're that young in life. And it was more of excitement. It was excitement more than fear. Anyway, as the story goes, well, you know the story now, but it went on, and the Prince of Wales was...
Yeah, how long was the firing going on for?
Well, the firing between the major ships was only going on for about 10 minutes before the Hood went up. And then we fired for about another 20 minutes after that. I imagine the Prince of Wales was also firing, but also had been damaged badly. And we were told that the Prince of Wales had to withdraw to repair its damage. And there it left Suffolk and Norfolk on their own with Bismarck and Prince Eugen. So it didn't look a very, very happy situation.
So what happened to the Suffolk?
Well, we were the leading ship because we had radar, which was able to keep in touch with the two German ships. And we were shadowing them and sending out enemy reports, so-called, every 15 minutes.
So you withdrew from the action after the Prince of Wales decided to leave?
Well, we weren't firing our guns anymore, but we were following the Bismarck.
What sort of distance?
About 13 miles. We knew the Bismarck had been hit because we were told that she was leaving a trail of oil slick behind her. and she was down by the bows, so she had been hit. But, how much, I don't know.